So now we've talked about theories of ethical practice. We've talked about codes of ethics. Let's move from that into looking at ethical challenges in healthcare, because they are getting greater all the time. I remember as a young practitioner, I got very upset if I had an ethical dilemma ever so often. We now have ethical dilemmas on a much more regular basis. People say to me, my practice is just one big ethical dilemma given where I work and what I do. And that's very trying, because if you're a good practitioner, ethical dilemmas require a lot of work and a lot of thought. And they are increasing as the world gets more complex. One of the things when I was in school in the Dark Ages that we didn't talk a lot about was cultural diversity. But ethical dilemmas are coming up regularly because of different cultural approaches to doing things. I read recently that the American Psychiatric Association posed the question in the early 80s, does one size fit all in treatment? So they did what any good association does, and they put together a task force to study it for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, they came back and said, yes, we should consider culture because it may not fit. What we do may not fit for everybody. So since then, we have gone on the fast track to look at different cultures. We read books about ethnicity and culture and how it affects treatment, and this is good. Because if we do not ethically respect where our clients are coming from, we are not a very ethical practitioner. There's a wonderful book, and I of course can't think of the name of the person who did it, but the computer will find it if you put in "The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down." This is about the medical treatment of a young Hmong child that's parents came to the United States from Laos. And it's sad to read, because the medical system didn't think about her family and how they did things. The child would get ill. They would prescribe antibiotics. They assumed every good American knew how to take antibiotics. The family would take the pills home. They would crush them. They would put them in water. They would water a plant with them. A couple of weeks later, they would harvest the leaves of the plant and make tea for the child. The antibiotics were obviously not working at this point, but nobody asked. Nobody thought, are you different than the way I ordinarily do things? I think we have to include culture and be culturally sensitive to be an ethical practitioner. The whole notion around gifts comes up every time I teach this. And some of us were taught gifts, no, never, ever. But what does that do? I taught this recently in an agency, a large agency that works with the homeless population, and they have a rule that says no gifts ever, ever, ever from clients. And one of the workers said, nearly killed me. And she gave a very interesting example. She had been working with a homeless man for almost 2 years as a case manager. He was doing very well. Their work had gone well together, and it was termination time. And he was quite an artist, and he had painted her a small painting, and he had made the frame for the painting. And according to her agency's rules, she couldn't accept it because it was a gift. And I read their agency code, and it was very clear, no gifts of any kind. I was horrified and said, you know, I have great concerns about what this did to what had been a wonderful relationship. Yes, I understand about gifts and that you have to question them, but to not understand the importance of food in some cultures, to not understand the importance of gift giving in some cultures, is not good ethical practice. I had a social worker who works in a large healthcare setting very recently in a workshop who said that they had had a patient come in from a foreign country whose life was saved by a trauma surgeon. And at the end of the treatment, the family gave this young female trauma surgeon a diamond necklace because it was a very wealthy family. That was what you did in their culture. And of course, people went crazy. And the social worker was asked to mediate between the patient's family and the young surgeon so that she could refuse the gift in a way that did not offend the family. I was delighted that the hospital saw that as a role for a social worker who recognized cultural need but agency policy. So we really have to look at diversity when we're thinking about ethical challenges. Questions related to life-expanding technology also cause us to have ethical pause on a very regular basis. I work in a city that's so high-tech that we can keep almost anybody alive for great, great periods of time. Sometimes, according to family members, long past when the person should be kept alive. The questions about technology is, who gets it? How long do they get it? Do they get it at all? And who has the right to make the decision? Legislatures in some states have given the right to termination of treatment to facilities whose ethics committee deems that that treatment is futile. Read between the lines, cost too much and not doing very much good. For some folks, this violates their cultural beliefs. This violates their religious beliefs. But the ethics committee can say, we will no longer provide this treatment. You have every right to move them somewhere else. You have every right to get another doctor, but we will no longer give you this life-expanding technology. Or, on the other hand, I had a young supervisee come to me who worked in a very strictly regulated managed care environment. A young woman had been seeing her for some short-term treatment. The young woman had advanced breast cancer. She had three young children under the age of 10. They had basically told her, we've done everything we can do. The young woman was very technologically savvy, was a professional herself, went on the internet, found a new experimental treatment that had been showing very, very, very good effects with her stage of breast cancer. She went to her physician, she asked for the treatment. He told her he didn't think it would do her any good. He came to the social worker and said, talk her out of it, it costs too much. He wasn't answering whether or not it would do any good. He was very clear that it didn't fit into their finances. The young social worker, bless her heart, was beside herself. Went over the doctor's head saying that she ethically could not cooperate with what she had been asked to do. And was fired. And said to me, I did what I had to do ethically. Another question about life expanding technology is, by whose definition? And this kind of bleeds into the divergent views about quality of life. If we have very strong beliefs about quality of life, what do we do with people that quality doesn't matter? It's life that is important. Someone gave the example of a woman that had been married to her husband for 70 years. He was in a hospital. He was on a ventilator. He wasn't going to make it. And the hospital tried very, very hard to get her to terminate treatment because they felt that he had no quality of life. The nurses and the professionals that were taking care of him were horrified that he was being kept alive because they felt they were torturing him. One of them said, "We're torturing him." The wife was adamant that this man was to remain a full code. The social worker was called in to talk with the wife and to talk with the nurses. The chaplain had been there. Everybody had been there. The social worker finally was able to sit down with the wife and hear her story about their marriage. This man and this woman had never been apart until he came into the hospital. And she came in her late 80s. Every morning at 6 o'clock when her son dropped her off, she went home every afternoon or every evening at 10 o'clock when her son picked her up. The staff was worried about quality of life. For this woman, there were two questions. Is he alive or is he dead? Alive gave her a reason for existing. She was there with him. She wanted to be there with him. It gave her meaning. So her question was, alive, not quality. So we had very divergent views that had to be negotiated. They, according to the report, never solved these divergent views, and probably a higher power stepped in and decided it was his time to go, and the man died in spite of all of the machines. But there was a great ethical challenge. The other ethical challenge we see is issues of professional authority and patient or client autonomy. We like to think we know what's best for everybody. We like to think that we listen to what they want and then we help them reach what they want. Many of us have been trained in motivational interviewing, which puts a different slant on who's the boss here. But I think many of us still struggle with, I know what's best. They call it paternalism. They maybe should call it maternalism also. But mom and dad know what's best. That's not workable ethically. People have the right to self-determination. I was challenged by a medical practitioner that has been in the business a very long time, who is just overwhelmed that his patients are now looking up what he prescribes to them, what he says to them, what he diagnoses them with on some search engine. And they're coming back and they're asking questions. And that's a problem for him. He's practiced most of his professional life looking at me MD, me know best. He doesn't like to be challenged. But now he is facing ethical dilemmas because they are saying, nope, we don't want to do it this way. We want to do it that way. I remember many years ago going to an older MD who was going to give me some kind of medicine, and I made the terrible mistake of asking him to explain to me what it was for and how long it was going to take to fix whatever it was for. And he said to me, young woman, when you've gone to medical school, I will answer those questions. Well, I've always been kind of a rebel, and he never got a chance to answer those questions because I never went back to him. He did not know what was best for me without me knowing what he was thinking. But professional authority and autonomy, especially when we are dealing with non-compliant people, when we are dealing with people that somewhere in our values are doing things that we've been taught are bad or wrong, we have a lot of trouble ethically. And do we fire them from care because they're being bad? I don't think so. Ethically, no. If they run out of money, if their health plan says, not going to pay for it anymore, and they're in the middle of treatment, what do we do? What is the ethical challenge of continuing treatment when there's no payer source? This may become much more pertinent for us in the future. There are three basic orientations that guide our ethical practice. One is a clinical orientation for the patient or the client's needs. I am going to base everything I do on what I see as their need. The second is a defensive orientation to practice. I'm going to do what I do to protect myself, or to protect my practice, or to protect my agency. Doesn't matter what they want. I'm going to do what protects me, the collective us, not the client. The third is an amoralistic orientation that, being social workers, scares us a little bit, and we fight against it from time to time. It's the absence of value-based concepts and an emphasis on program evaluation and outcomes and cost-benefits analysis. This is, you can't do that, it costs too much. Or, we're not going to spend this much on one person if it deprives other people of services. And we kind of bristle when we hear that because we see everybody as an individual. Is one of these best? Is one of these worst? No. We do all three of these. We cannot not do all three of these and practice ethically. Of course we look out for the patient's needs. But we also do things to defend ourselves. We don't give in to people when they say, I'm going to sue you if you do that. It scares you, yes. But do we give in? No, we shouldn't. If we didn't think about how much it cost, what is the value, we wouldn't have jobs because there wouldn't be any money to pay us. We have to look at, is this practice benefiting people? We are beginning to do more of this all of the time, with more short-term means of treatment that give results that we know are research-defended. So we have to find a balance with every one of our clients in these three orientations. And until we do that, we get really upset. Young practitioners, I'm going to do it if it's what the client needs, regardless. That is not going to work for them. But that is a very idealistic approach that sometimes you need to help them balance so they don't feel like they're selling out, folks. Our intervention is only as good as our assessment and the diagnosis, or whatever term feels most comfortable for you, that flows from this assessment. If we've not done a good assessment, we can't come up with a good solution for the problem. I did a presentation where a woman was telling us about an ethical dilemma she had between herself and a social work graduate student that was not being good on the weekends. They were doing pretty unlawful things on the weekends, but they were fine at placement. And she had a question about what should she do, since it wasn't related to the work they were doing. And we came up with all kinds of good interventions for her. And we had done a diagnosis of the situation, and we were ready for her to move. And after we had all come up with this, she just happened to mention that the young man had been arrested and was out on bond and had charges pending, which changed absolutely everything we had talked about. So, do you have as many of the facts as you can gather? Have you asked the right questions to get the facts you need to gather? Have you come up with a diagnostic statement, whether it be DSM or a social diagnosis, that fits those facts? And have you gone from there to a treatment plan that fits the diagnosis? And if you're a member of a multidisciplinary team, what happens if there's a disagreement over the treatment plan? Who takes precedence on the team if somebody changes yours? Whose responsibility is that? And what responsibility do you have to operate under something you don't agree with? Is the problem that you've assessed and diagnosed fixable? What's the probability of success with the intervention that you have planned? Is this a band-aid that you're putting on something? Is it something that you know is going to reduce a symptom for a short period of time or solve a short-term problem, but is not going to lead to any long-term good outcome for someone? And how can the person that you're working with benefit from the treatment? Or does the research study benefit from the treatment? Or does the bottom line benefit from the treatment? Is this a private client in a private practice that really is worried well and is long since past what they really need in the way of treatment, but they have a large checkbook and they're helping you pay your bills? Is that a good indication for intervention ethically? No, I don't think so. Tempting, but not a good ethical approach. The second thing we look at is the preference of the patient or client. What a novel approach to think about what do they want instead of what do we think is good for them. When we're thinking about preference, we need to make sure ethically that people have all the information that they need to make a decision. This is the research-informed consent. This is the therapeutic rules that I go by in my practice, making sure that they are informed about what is going to happen, how it's going to happen, the notion of outcome that you may think will be there, or what is their notion of outcome. What is their capacity to make their preferences known? If someone is judged by a court to be incompetent and not have capacity, do they have a right to make treatment decisions? In some places they do, and in some places they don't. But what is their capacity? All of us have had the experience of calling an adult protective service agency and saying, oh dear, this person is leaving against medical advice. They're doing things they should not be doing. They are going to get themselves in a lot of trouble if they continue to do this. And the first question you get asked is, do they have capacity to make their own decisions? And if the answer is yes, they may send services, but they are very quickly going to tell you, ethically, people have the right to make bad decisions if they have the capacity to know what they're doing. I remember in graduate school, a faculty person that we all revered was talking about failure of treatment and how young professionals got very, very upset when people, quote, didn't do what they were supposed to do because we knew what was best. And he said he remembered as a young professional sitting with a supervisor and talking about a case that he had had great, great difficulty with and seemed to be going nowhere. And he said, kind of serendipitously, the client walked by the room where they were. And he looked out the window and he saw the client, and he started even more forcefully talking with the supervisor about, have I done this right? Have I done that right? This is what I've done. That's what I've done. And he said the supervisor, who was old and very experienced, looked at him and said, you know, in spite of our best efforts, some people just go to hell in a handbasket, and that's their right. And he said that made a lasting impression on him. And I think it did on us. Preferences. What about the client that says, I'm going to do it, and they go out over and over and over and don't do it? What's going on? What's the resistance? What are they saying to you preferentially by that behavior? Do we always respect self-determination? We should, unless it is obvious that it's going to lead to a very, very lethal outcome. And then there are people that ask, okay, do people have a right to hurt themselves? You can get into a big ethical discussion about that. You can get into big ethical discussions around abortion. You can get into big ethical discussions about the person's right to do what they do. The third topic is quality of life. What about return to normal functioning? What if I do everything I know how and it's only a little bit of success? When do I accept what I define as a little bit of success? What is normal to them may ethically be abnormal to us. We have to deal with that. Are there biases or prejudices about quality of life? I remember as a young graduate student going out to see a blind veteran. And I was in one of those VA cars, and I felt pretty powerful. And I got there, it was the dead of winter, it was very cold. I found a house with an older man in it who had very little furniture. He only had a very small space heater. He was blind. That scared me a lot. None of the windows closed. I sat down, I did the best assessment I knew how. He wanted a Braille watch. That was all. In spite of my best efforts to convince him that I could do almost wondrous things for him, like getting his house made warmer and this, that, and the other, he was adamant that all he wanted from me was a Braille watch. I went back to my wise and wonderful field instructor, very upset, and confessed that I had failed. And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, all he wanted was a watch, and I couldn't talk him into anything else." And she said to me, "You would have failed if you had talked him into it, because that's all he wanted." She said, "You give him that, and maybe the next time you go see him, the trust issues will be different, and he will accept something else from you." He did. The next time I went, he then wanted a machine that played talking books. So I got him that. But it really was beyond me to believe that there I was, armed with all of my upper middle class values, that I could have given him all the things that would have made me comfortable, and he didn't want them. So my biases about quality of life needed a lot of ethical tweaking. And I will always be grateful, and 40 years later, have not forgotten what the field instructor said. Does the client's future quality of life seem undesirable to them? If I make you all better, how is that going to impact you in the future? I work with a lot of folks that work with substance abusers, and I'm one of those people that, you know, we got to fix it, and we got to fix it forever. But they're not, and it's a good thing they're not, because relapse is considered a part of treatment. And someone said to me once, "Listen, this guy's been sober 9 months, which is 7 months longer than he has been sober since he started using. That's success." That was a better quality for him. The fact that I had trouble with that didn't have anything to do with him. I was fortunately not treating him, because I probably would have pushed him so that he wouldn't have stayed sober as long as he did. Are there plans and rationales for people that want to stop treatment? Is it medical treatment that says, I've had it, I'm done, I want to die. What if you're in a research study? What if you're working in a research program and you've got a research protocol with clients and they say, "No more, I'm done"? Should you try to talk them into staying because you don't want them lost to the study? Or in the example I gave earlier, what if you were the young social worker who was told, "Talk them into stopping because it costs too much"? What are your plans ethically if everything fails? If they don't get better? If they don't want to get better? How do you deal with yourself with that? And with everything, there are contextual factors. Social, legal, economic, and institutional circumstances. Do we look just at the desires of the client? What about the family that's involved? What about the society that's involved? This is the thing that marks social workers as social workers. We look at people from person and environment. I do clinical consultation with several licensed professional counselors, and they tell me on a regular basis that they don't know why they pay me anymore, because I'm trying to turn them into social workers. But they come back, so I must be doing something right. But I find when they are assessing that they miss contextual factors. They don't look at the whole situation. To do good ethical practice, you really do have to look at everybody. Are there provider issues that might influence treatment? We're back to greed here. Somebody's paying me regularly, so they may need a little bit longer. Do I have personal unresolved countertransference that keeps people in treatment longer? If so, that's a real ethical issue for me. Financial and economic factors certainly play into everything we do now, and unfortunately are playing more and more into what we do. Allocation of scarce resources is right up there with the financial factors. What are the legal implications for what we're thinking about? You see this when you have a client in a healthcare setting that has an advance directive that says, don't want anything done. And they have an agent, a healthcare agent, and the person, the patient has lost their ability to make decisions, and the agent chickens out and comes to you and says, I want everything done. Legally, a physician can say, I'm sorry, we have a signed advance directive and we are going to abide by the patient's wishes. Medical legal lawyers say things like, well, yes, but dead patients do not sue, but live relatives do. What is the ethical issue here? What about research or teaching? All of us have had the ethical problem of the client in the agency that every member of the professional staff has seen, knows by name, knows by everything, and has not been able to get through. All of a sudden, this is a perfect student case. I think that's a very unethical approach, both to the teacher-student relationship, but certainly to the client-student relationship. Is there research going on? Do you push things beyond where they should be because of the research? I don't think so. Is there a conflict of interest between you and your agency? Does the agency say do it this way? Does your clinical sense say do it that way? This is a topic that's got to be resolved for the good of the client, because doing things where there is this kind of a conflict rarely have good outcomes, and usually for more than one person they don't have good outcomes. Let's break a little bit. Versus protection of confidentiality that we deal with in Texas. I'll give you an example. I have this hypothetical patient in my office. I have a home office, and this patient says to me, you know, my good for nothing mother-in-law lives down the street, and when I leave here, I'm a shooter. Well, I'm from Texas. They say all of us have guns. I don't. But he does. His pickup truck's in my driveway. I can see the rifle in the back, and he's probably got another one under the front seat. And I really believe he's going to shoot my neighbor. And so I have an ethical dilemma that says I can't call her. I can't violate confidentiality. But I really believe if I don't do that, something's going to happen to her that's not going to be nice. So I have an issue. I have an issue where law and ethics conflict. So what am I going to do? Well, knowing me, if I really, really, truly felt like he was going to do that, I would probably call her. I would probably call her and say, don't let anybody in your house. If you've got a gun, get it. But be safe. I'm calling the police. Well, technically, I would not have violated confidentiality, but the son-in-law, my client, could have brought me up on ethics charges for violating confidentiality. So what am I going to do? The law says I can call police or medical personnel, but I know that they're not going to get there fast enough because she doesn't live that far from me. So I have an ethical dilemma. And the issue is protection of life versus confidentiality. Legally, supposed to just not do anything except police or medical. That's not going to work. Professionally, protection of life. So I have to make a decision. If I go legally, I do nothing. If I go ethically, I do everything. So I've got two ends of a continuum here. Very often, when we define solutions based on two ends of a continuum, we miss the solution because it lives in the middle. If I say either or, I've only got two solutions. If I say, what can I do? I've got more to go on. Give you another example. Taught this to Children's Protective Service workers several years ago. One of them said, I've got it. I've got the case that you will never, ever, ever figure out. I said, okay. I was not going to. I was going to make them do it. She had been sent out to do an investigation on a young girl that was living with her mother and the mother's boyfriend. And there was an allegation of child sexual abuse. And family preservation is a big deal for us. And so she had to go looking for dad to see if the child could go live with dad. This is true. I'm not making it up. Dad lived in a satanic cult. So it was, in her mind, satanic cult versus possible child abuse. And we called her on it and said, you know, what are the issues here? What are the values and duties that you're conflicted with? Because she saw only two possible solutions. What was the question? Identify the problem. The problem was not satanic cult versus possible child abuse. The question was, what do I do with this kid? Which gave her a whole bunch of more possibilities when she was looking at the values and duties that conflicted. The next step in the process is to identify individuals, groups, and organizations that are likely to be affected by the decision. We often get caught in thinking, okay, here's one client, here's one of another person, institution, organization, and that's the only people involved. Well, no, that's not absolutely correct. You have to look at the players. In the case of this child and whether or not she should be removed from her home, there was the child, there was the father, there was the mother, there was the boyfriend, there were the members of the father's cult, there was the legal system, there was the medical system that was having to treat this child for some physical injuries. We could go on and on and on. But in looking at the individuals, groups, and organizations affected by whatever decision you make, you again broaden the number of solutions you may have. When this young CPS worker started looking at individuals, groups, and organizations, she then had a foster care system to possibly deal with. She had relatives of both the mother and the father to deal with. She was not stuck with an either-or decision, when in fact the answer was in the middle. So you have this long list, and to me, the longer the list of people that are involved, the more possibilities you have for solutions. Some other people think the longer the list of individuals you have involved, the more confused you become, and then you become immobilized. I don't think that always works that way. The third step in this process is to identify all the viable courses of action and the participants involved in each. along with the potential benefits and risk for each. People say to me, "You've got to be crazy. You don't understand the time constraints that we are bound under. I don't have time to do all of this stuff when I've got an on-the-spot decision." Well, we all do this whether we realize it and organize it that way or not. And one of the biggest difficulties in an ethical decision is being forced to make it quickly before you've thought it through. You are going to be responsible for that decision. So be willing to say, "I can't tell you right now. I have to have a little time to think about this." What are the courses of action? And who are the people involved in each of these, along with the benefits and risk for each? One of the things I heard initially from this young CPS worker was, she was thinking about mother, father, child, and boyfriend. The potential benefits and risk for each of these were multiple, but there were also a lot of other people for whom there were more positive outcomes possible. So I'm back to list making. You now know what the problem is, who's involved, what I can do, what are my options. But you've got to examine the reasons in favor and opposed to each of your options. And as you do that, you have to consider the following four things. You have to think about ethical theories. Is this going to benefit more than one person? What's the greater good here? What are the principles from that principle screen that we used? And what are guidelines? What do our codes of ethics say? What are the laws about child protection in this particular case say? Codes of ethics and legal principles have to be there. Even if they conflict, you have got to deal with what do they tell me to do, and you've got to make a decision about which you're going to hold yourself to the standard of. What are the practice theories and principles that you're dealing with if you're in a treatment situation? How do they factor into this? I have a problem with some recent very, very rigid new methods of providing treatment where you do 12 sessions by the book, don't vary from this at all. And what happens if those 12 sessions don't fit? Or what happens if people bring up things that you're not supposed to talk about because it was too far in the past? I've got to look at those kind of things before I decide what to do. What are my personal values? And those of the people that I'm dealing with, and how may they conflict? I was teaching this to a very large group of nurses several years ago. There were like 350 people in the room. When I said this, a nurse in the very back yelled, because she didn't have a microphone, that it was absurd that you had to totally take yourself out of the equation before you did anything. Well, that's very aspirational, but it's not reasonable. We are who we are. We have strong feelings about rightness or wrongness based on our own value system, our own practice system, our own profession, even sometimes our own politics. And while we cannot impose those on our clients through our decision-making process, we have to be aware that we can't let them not influence us. We have to examine, is our countertransference getting in the way of what I'm doing? And that scares people, but it's true. somebody was telling me about having grown up in a very, very, very strict Catholic home. This was kind of a personal and not a professional experience for them. And a friend of theirs had chosen to have an abortion. And these were two grown-ups, and she really said, if this is what you want and this is what you can live with, don't ask me what I think, because it's all about you, it's not about me. And she was asked to take her friend to the clinic because the friend didn't particularly want her very religious family to know what she was doing. And she asked her if she'd, you know, stay the night with her, like she was supposed to have somebody there. And this woman told me that she was fine, that she had reasoned this out in her very reasonable adult mind until she sat down in the waiting room of the clinic. And she said every ounce of Catholic education and teaching that she had ever had suddenly fell on the top of her head. She said she nearly died of guilt. She said she had to do an awful lot of talking to herself because she was so surprised how a church that she no longer attended, that she no longer believed in a lot of the things that they taught, had, because of early training, had so much impact on her. She said it was like a ton of bricks. So our personal values are there when we're working with our clients. So we have to factor that in to make sure that our values are not influencing the way we're dealing with our ethical dilemmas. The next step is consulting with colleagues and appropriate experts, agency staff, supervisors, agency administrators, attorneys, or ethics scholars. All of us that work in an agency setting, the minute we have an ethical issue, need to beat a path to the supervisor. I know from being a supervisor that I want to hear problems from my staff before I hear them from someone else. I tell them, I cannot defend what you are doing unless I've heard your side of the story. What steps have you taken? What have you done? It's important that the agency know about your ethical dilemmas, because you cannot, as a representative of that agency, make those decisions totally on your own. Attorneys, most of you, if you have serious ethical dilemmas, your agency attorney is involved. If you're in private practice and there's a serious ethical dilemma, you may want to consult a private attorney. Ethics scholars are kind of hard to get an appointment with, so you might not always be able to find one of them. But also, your peers are very helpful in situations when you have an issue. Why do I say this? How many times have we thought, oh dear, what do I do now? I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. So you find your colleague in the next office and say, I got to tell you about this. I've just got to tell you what's going on. And you tell the story. And your colleague has sat there very quietly through all of this. And all of a sudden you stop and you say, well, of course that's what I should do. The very action of telling that story has helped you get it from your gut to your head, because you've had to run it through enough filters to get the information in an intellectual form in which you can discuss it. So very often you solve your own problem just by telling somebody about it. Finally, you have got to make the decision. It's up to you, if you have responsibility for what's going on, to make the decision. And it says document the decision-making process. Does that mean write it in a chart? Probably not. That means I need something that says to me, okay, I decided to do this at this moment based on this. These were the people involved. This is what I looked at. this is why I made this decision. One of the reasons we tell you to do this is, again, we may have one problem, we may have five practitioners, we may have five different solutions. So why did you choose to do it the way you did it? You need a model to go with. And then you think, oh good, it's over. I'm fine, I'm free, I've made my decision. I think it's the right one, I can justify it, I can stand by it. But no, you're not quite finished. You have to monitor that decision, you have to evaluate it, and you may have to document a change in the decision. Because in some cases, you're all done, you're all finished, and you get one more tiny bit of information that may change everything you've done, that you have to fit into this model, and you have to rethink what you have done to come to a proper solution. Ethical decision making is not cut and dry. It's a process, much like an assessment is a process, that you make the best decision based on the information you have, knowing that additional information may change the overall outcome of the decision making. I hope this has been helpful to you. I hope you will take something away from this that says, oh, okay, maybe I should think about doing it that way. Remember, we know initially that we have an ethical problem when we have a feeling that something's wrong. We need to get that feeling into our head so that we can make a measured, respectful, professional decision. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
See,
I did it 2 hours just like she said.